I'm so glad that you're here. I'm glad that you love the Lord and that you love to worship Him in this place. I'm glad that I'm a part of this church family. My wife and I went to Charleston yesterday to see our daughter, who's a student at the College of Charleston. And as we spent time together and I got caught up on how our classes are going and how her experience in the sorority she joined is going, I found myself, nevertheless, and this is just a problem I have, I guess, but I found myself, nevertheless, wanting to hear signs of spiritual life and faith in her as she shared her college experience with me. And I heard it yesterday in some of the ways that God is working in her life. I'm hearing it in you again today, as I do each week, as you express your hunger and thirst for God. And so I just feel really blessed to again be with you this morning. Now, the sermon is about something weddings and funerals have in common. And, when I thought about that, I thought I probably should tell some corny jokes about weddings and funerals, because it just sounds sort of, what does a wedding and funeral have in common? I've got some corny jokes written on my paper here, but I think they're too corny to share, so I'm just going to spare you the misery. But there is one about what weddings and funerals have in common. What do weddings and funerals have in common? At the end of the day, a stiff gets buried either way. And it's just so lame. It's just so lame. And that's not what I'm going to be sharing with you this morning. Jesus has something so much better to share with you this morning about what weddings and funerals have in common. We're going to get there in just a couple of minutes. But we'll start this way by thinking about one phrase in one of our memory verses. And that's the phrase, outwardly we are wasting away. And we moan and complain about how that's true. Outwardly we are wasting away. But you know what it means when we stop wasting away? We're dead. And not many people I know are fans of death. Aristotle called death the thing to be feared most because it appears to be the end of everything. Jean-Paul Sartre asserted that death removes all meaning from life. Because you're just going to die, and so what's the point of all this life if you're just going to die and cease to exist? You don't hear many people talking about the virtues of death. Like no parades being held in honor of death. No awards ceremony presentations given to death. People just aren't big fans of death. There are exceptions. There are times when certain people covet death. Terminally ill patients who've experienced enormous physical suffering for a long time sometimes just wish for death to come their way. There are aged people living in limited circumstances who I've heard say, I don't know why I'm still here. I've had a good life. I'm just ready to move on. They covet death. And then there are those cases where people dealing with mental illness try to take their own lives and covet death that way. And if you're here this morning and you're thinking about ending your life, I want to encourage you to speak to me or to someone else about what you're thinking about. Please don't keep that hidden to yourself. Share it with somebody. I only knew him for a couple of weeks when I went to see him in the hospital when he was having those kinds of thoughts about taking his own life. I think about where he is today, some 6 years later from that moment, thriving, full of joy, full of hope. And I'm just grateful that he didn't believe the lie that the world was better off without him, because that's what it is when we're thinking that way. It's a lie from the enemy. And so if you're being tempted to believe that lie in your own life, please come and talk with me or someone else. People offer solutions to death as a way to prevent it from happening in our lives. Doctors, scientists, physical fitness gurus. I love this cartoon. The doctor says to one of his patients, so what fits your busy schedule? Exercising 1 hour a day or being dead 24 hours a day? Sometimes doctors don't fight fair as they try to get us to do things that we really don't feel like doing. But they're just trying to delay death. And there are plenty of religions who offer ideas on how to overcome death. One suggests reincarnation. One suggests detachment from the physical world. A branch of one suggests that martyrdom is the way to paradise. There's even one that says death, like pain and evil, they don't exist. They're just figments of your imagination. But we see it happening every day. And yet we're often surprised by it, aren't we? You ever notice that? Like even if you knew someone who was terminal, and then you get the call that he's died, still you have that initial like shock or surprise. Or when some tragedy happens like 9/11, 3,000 people die on one day, it's just like very, very shocking and surprising to us. And yet it happens every day to over 7,000 people in our country. And children, they usually outgrow their separation anxiety by age 2. But sometimes we as adults can still experience separation anxiety, even just thinking about death, thinking about being separated from someone we love. And I wonder if that's what's going on in the hearts of the disciples in John chapter 14. You'll recognize these words as they come on the screen. It's where Jesus says to them, "Don't let your hearts be troubled. Trust in God, trust also in me. In my Father's house are many rooms. If it were not so, I would have told you. I'm going there to prepare a place for you. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come back and take you to be with me, that you also may be where I am." So what's troubling the 12? Well, in the previous chapter over dinner, they were just given 3 pieces of information that was very troubling. One of the 12 was going to betray Jesus soon. 2, Jesus was going to leave them. He was going to die. And 3, one of the 12, Peter, was going to deny even knowing Jesus. Now, that's like a lot of information to digest over one dinner. But I think the most troubling of those 3 was the fact that the one they had been with for 3 years straight was now going to leave them. He was going to die. And even though Jesus had told them that that was what was going to happen in Jerusalem for some time, they, like us, chose to live in denial of that truth. They're like, no, that's not going to happen. That's not going to happen. That's not going to happen. And again, Jesus says here, it is going to happen, and it's going to happen very soon. And they hear that, and they're troubled in heart. I'm wondering what's troubling you in your heart this morning. Maybe none for a few of you. Maybe you're really good this morning. Not a care in the world. But I got to think that for most of us here, there's something troubling us in our hearts. Maybe something that we did 10 years ago that pops up in our consciousness every now and then and it just troubles our hearts. Maybe an argument with a loved one that we haven't repaired yet and it's just still living inside of us and it's troubling in our hearts. Maybe it's some kind of physical problem that we're dealing with that's really troubling in our hearts. Everybody usually has something. I was reading about this guy who went to a psychiatrist. He laid on the psychiatrist's couch, and he started telling the psychiatrist about all of his worries. He said, "Doc, I'm worried about the energy crisis, inflation, the situation in the Middle East, political and social upheaval in Africa, our diplomatic relations with China, the stock market, this mole on my neck, my son's unemployment." Psychiatrist interrupted him and said, "Shut up and move over. I need to lie down too." Just overwhelmed. I think that's how the 12 felt in John 14. How we sometimes feel. Just overwhelmed. And Jesus has a solution for the overwhelmed heart. Get ready. This is it. Trust in God. Trust also in me. really. Trust me. That's the solution. Don't you love it when people offer that to you as their solution to your relationship issues and struggles? Just trust me. You know, telemarketers, salesmen, politicians, really, just trust me. Really, is it that easy? Some of us have some real trust issues. Either we trust too easily or we never trust at all. But about trust issues, about trusting somebody, we kind of have to know their history. Kind of have to know our history with them. We have to consider the object of our trust before we're willing to push that button and trust someone. And so when Jesus said, trust in God, trust also in me, do you hear what he's saying? He's saying, you know, the way you trust God, your good, good Father, you can trust me just like that because we're one and the same. In fact, Jesus has said that several times to them. I and the Father are one, therefore claiming to be God. When Peter said, you're the Christ, the Son of the living God, Jesus said, you're right, I am. And earlier Jesus said, before Abraham was born, I am. Trust God, trust also in me. But when life is troubling us, we find it sometimes very difficult to trust. So how do we work our way through that? The answer is, consider the object of your trust. And so when Jesus says, trust me, guys, they think, okay, we've known Jesus for 3 years. Let's think about our history with him. Has he ever lied to us? Has he ever, like, sold us out? Has he ever broken a promise? Have we ever seen him do anything that would embarrass us? Anything that would be considered a violation of God's law? Jesus even said to his earthly enemies once, convict me of sin, guys. If there's anything that you've seen that I've done wrong, please convict me. And they couldn't. In fact, to get him charged with a crime before he was crucified, they had to lie, right, and make up stuff because there was nothing about Jesus you couldn't trust. And so when Jesus says, trust me, they're thinking, okay, yeah, I can trust Jesus, and so can you. But nevertheless, we still have some periodic doubts. I'm thinking about Elijah, this like hero of Old Testament faith, and his difficulty in trusting God, and here's why. What he thought should happen didn't happen. He goes to Mount Carmel. He challenges the prophets of Baal. He's going to expose them for all of their lies. God's power is going to be revealed to everyone, and when it is, all of the Israelites are going to experience spiritual revival and start calling on the name of the Lord again. Well, Elijah got part of that story right. God did reveal his power, did expose the prophets of Baal for all of their lies, but spiritual revival did not take place in Israel. And when it didn't, Elijah went into hiding. Queen Jezebel put out a hit on him. She was going to remove him from the face of the earth. And between that death threat and his great disappointment with God, Elijah finds himself in the wilderness, all alone, refusing to eat and drink. He just wants to die. And then God shows up, just like he shows up in your life. And God says, Elijah, I want you to eat. I want you to drink. And then I want you to get up and go anoint this king in that country, this king in that country, in this prophet to succeed you. What did Elijah learn? Just because his plan wasn't God's plan didn't mean God doesn't have a plan. And when you are having your doubts because things aren't happening the way you thought they should happen and expected them to happen, and you're greatly disappointed by it, just because your plan isn't God's plan doesn't mean God doesn't have a plan. And the disciples in John 14 are going to have to learn this lesson. How can they trust Jesus? Because, man, he always has a plan. And when things aren't going the way they thought they would go, they needed to learn that nevertheless, God had a plan. So what's his plan and what's his promise? Jesus said in verse 2, in my Father's house are many rooms. Whoa, whoa. I prefer the King James Version translation to that one, don't you? Doesn't it sound better? In my Father's house are many mansions. Doesn't that sound better than many rooms? Isn't that what you've been banking on for all of your earthly life, that you're going to get your mansion? And we even sing the song, I'm satisfied with just a cottage below, a little silver, a little gold, because we've got a mansion over the hilltop. We lie when we sing. We're not satisfied with a little cottage below. That's why we're always upgrading. Little more and a little more and a little more. I'm about to burst your bubble. If you've been banking on a mansion in heaven one day, it's not the word in the text. The King James folks, they took that Latin word for mansionis, found the closest English word, mansion, to connect with it, but it's not what the word means. It means many rooms are lodging places. You're not going to have a mansion in heaven, but I guarantee you're still going to love it. In fact, do you really want a mansion? All of the upkeep in heaven? All of the cleaning and dusting? Believe me, you're better off without a mansion. But what Jesus is promising is a place for you. And that really strikes at one of our common fears in life, right? Wherever it is, on the team, in the school, on the job, in the family. Is there room for me? Is there a place for me too? And Jesus says, I'm going, but where I'm going, there is a place for you. And he makes the promise, I'm going there to prepare a place for you. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come back and take you to be with me. Man, we don't get this in our culture, but I would bet you a dollar that when the apostles heard those words, the hair on the back of their neck stood up, because they had heard those words before. Because those were the words that a groom would share with his bride before they culminated their marriage. The groom would get permission from both sides of the family that they could marry. And then he would go to his bride and he would say, I'm going there to prepare a place for you. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come back and take you to be with me. Now that place would be back at his daddy's house, where he would build on an addition, where he and his bride could live. And once he had prepared that place for her, he would go back and say, I told you, I'm coming to take you. Do you see what's happening here? Jesus is equating the great hope of a wedding to now the great hope of our funerals, our deaths. Only Jesus can pull this off. The great hope that we experience when we're about to get married is now the great hope we can experience when we are about to die. That is the promise, that is the plan that Jesus is making to his disciples here. And we've got a few church members who are presently making wedding plans for family members. And that's exciting, isn't it? It can be. It can be draining, I know, as well. But it's like exciting. But what about your funeral plans? Ugh. Who makes plans for their funerals? We'd rather not talk about, you know, death. We'd rather like pretend like it's not going to happen. But the blessing of being a Christian is that we no longer have to live in fear of death. And instead, there's this great hope that is promised to us in death. I was thinking about, you know, when you get married or about to get married, the kind of hopes that you have. Now, we're losing that in our culture a great deal today, because a lot of people live together and get married later on, or never get married at all. And so like the wedding day, it's just not what it used to be when you didn't do that. And so you spend a lot of time thinking about what it's going to be like, you know, to live with that person and to share intimacy and companionship with that person. And so, you know, from that paradigm, right, there's just a lot of hope. Man, a lot of excitement about that wedding day. And I think what Jesus is saying is, you know, that hope that you have when you say, okay, I'm taking you to be with me, you can now say about my death when we're separated. And you can now say about your death when you're separated. on my wedding day, my first glimpse of Diana as she came up the stairs and began to walk down Me Money's walkway in front of her home. My first glimpse of her when I saw her for the first time was like tears. I started crying. I wonder what it'll be like when I get my first glimpse of Jesus. I can only imagine what it will be like when I walk by his side. I can only imagine what my eyes will see when his face is before me. While I dance for you, Jesus, maybe. Or in all of you, be still. While I stand in your presence, or to my knees will I fall. While I sing hallelujah, will I be able to speak at all? You and I can only imagine, but church, do we ever spend any time on this earth imagining? That's my fear. That we're so tied to this earth that we lose the great blessing that comes with imagining what it will be like when we are with Jesus. It was Martin Luther who said, "I'd rather be in hell with Jesus than in heaven without him." That was his way of expressing the Christian's great desire to be with Jesus wherever Jesus is. In church, we need to have that desire, and that desire isn't living with us day after day as we move about on this planet. Something's not functioning right in our spiritual systems, because that is the great desire that comes with following Jesus Christ. Now, I know we're going to equate funerals with weddings. Some of us got married with great hopes only to see those hopes dashed. Betrayal, abuse, divorce took place, and there's like this fear. Could what happened there happen here? Could we be greatly disappointed by Jesus at our deaths? That's when the Apostle Paul in 1 Corinthians 15 expressed similar doubts. And as one writer put Paul's logic in that chapter, he wrote, "You know, if one person claimed a post-cross encounter with Jesus, you could disregard it. Man, he just was imagining he saw Jesus alive after his death. If a dozen people offered depositions that they saw Jesus alive after he died, maybe you could chalk that up to mob hysteria. Didn't really happen. But when 50 people saw him, 100 people saw him, 300, 500 people saw Jesus alive, when one testimony expands to hundreds, disbelief becomes belief." They didn't see a ghost. They didn't see a phantom. They saw Jesus in the flesh, alive after he died. The promise for us is not found just in the empty tomb, but it's found in the living Lord who is seen by many, alive after his death. And so that is why we know we will not be left at the altar by Jesus at our death. We believe in God. We have every good reason to believe in Jesus too. Charles Lindbergh was the first to fly over the Atlantic Ocean, and before he died, he asked the minister to include these words: "Death is but a new adventure. Our last glimpse of this earth will be our first glimpse of Jesus." I can only imagine. May we be a church who uses our imagination to think about Jesus in the day-to-day movements of our lives, as we do our jobs and raise our families and bless our neighbors. May we think about Jesus in those times. But may we also think about Jesus at the end of our time, when we're no longer wasting away, but fully in the presence of Jesus. Life begins when we are born again of the water and the Spirit. If you're ready to be baptized in the Christ for the forgiveness of your sins, if you need prayer or counsel from us this morning, a word of encouragement, meet me down front and tell me how we can help you as we stand and sing about going to heaven one day. Let's stand and sing.